I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Can your drinking water contain a safe amount of hazardous chemicals? It's a big issue for those with contaminated wells near military facilities in Bucks and Montgomery counties. But as WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports, questions about water contaminated with the substance PFOA shows safe is up for negotiation.
PFOA is in a lot of consumer goods, like the Teflon used in a manufacturing plant in Hoosick Falls, New York. The Environmental Protection Agency recommended residents there to stop consuming the water late last year.
People having to use bottled water to brush their teeth, even to cook.
All because a dangerous chemical was found in the water supply.
That's from a local ABC News report back in January. PFOA is also a component in high-powered firefighting materials, like the kind used for decades in simulations at former military bases in Warminster and Horsham. But the response has not been the same. In Hoosick, the EPA said that no well tested with more than 100 parts per trillion could be used for cooking or drinking. In Bucks and Montgomery counties, the advisory level is four times higher, 400 parts per trillion. Warminster Township Environmental Advisory Council member Larry Menkes says various levels of government are treating the question of when to intervene here like a political hot potato.
The initial reaction was, look, we don't want people to get the impression it's our responsibility.
In a statement, EPA spokesman Mike DeAndrea said they set the lower level in New York because the company responsible for the contamination there was making free bottled water available to the community. Also, the state health department in New York had offered to test every resident's private well. In other words, they could afford to be extra cautious, says Menkes.
The lower you recognize the standard being, the more expensive it gets to take care of the people.
Warminster officials and Bucks County Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick are urging the Navy and the EPA to adopt a lower, more conservative standard here. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
The White House this week announced additional steps to combat the growing epidemic of prescription drug abuse and heroin addiction. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports that part of that effort has several dozen medical schools, including some in Philadelphia, promising to revamp classes on prescribing opioids.
About 60 med schools from around the country told the White House that starting next semester, students must get some form of education on chronic pain and prescribing drugs in order to graduate. Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine was on the list. Dr. Richard German directs the school's Neuromusculoskeletal Institute.
So when this came out and the dean called me and he said, well, this is what we're doing, it allowed me then to really power my curriculum even more to say, hey, we're now all agreeing that I'm as important as cardiology is, right? So this curriculum is that important, and it's going to be that way in the country. So it's really a big deal.
German says there wasn't much in the way of any of this when he first started, but for the last 10 years, the school's had a mandated pain course. In the fall, they'll be doubling the amount of time students spend in their clinical rotation for pain management. The White House pledge includes incorporating new federal guidelines that urge doctors, especially those in primary care, to be more cautious when prescribing potentially addictive narcotics. The two Philly schools that have signed on are Penn and the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Tanaz Razuli, with the Association of American Medical Colleges, says, pledge or not, just about all schools are addressing opioids in some way.
The vast majority of schools include content on substance abuse in one or more required classes in both preclinical coursework and through clinical rotation.
But she says the approaches vary. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
There are merely two hurdles in Houston remaining for the Villanova Wildcats to claim the NCAA 2016 Men's Basketball Championship title. Let's check in on preparations to get past the first roadblock with Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Bob Ford. Bob, thanks for joining us from Houston.
Good to be with you, Dave.
First, what's the vibe?
The vibe is good. Anytime you get your program or your team to the Final Four, you're happy. You've had a great year. Obviously, you still want more. You would like to be able to one that holds that trophy up at the end. But just getting this far is an affirmation of everything you've done and everything you've worked for all year long.
Now we're learning that Villanova is a poised team. They're not afraid of going at it. But NRG Stadium with some 76,000 fans, that's a whole different kind of playing, isn't it?
It is, and it's kind of interesting. The NCAA does this every year. You play all of your games, 35 games, whatever, leading up to this in a gym or in an arena, and then all of a sudden you're in the middle of what looks like an aircraft carrier with 70,000 people, and it's a whole different environment that you have to adjust to. I don't think the moment will overwhelm Villanova. I think they're a settled team, they're a veteran team, and I think they're going to play well.
It seems like years rather than months ago that Oklahoma more or less crushed Villanova earlier this season. That was a different team then. To what extent is Villanova at the peak of their game?
Well, they're certainly far different from December when they played Oklahoma before, and that night was really an anomaly for them. They simply shot terribly from three-point range. Villanova's a very good three-point range shooter. They've progressed a lot from that point. They've really matured, but also they're a hot team. And, you know, at this time of year, you can't predict that. You just hope it happens. And all four of the teams here are hot, and Villanova is as hot as any of them.
Led in large measure by their two senior stars, Ryan Arcidiacono and Daniel Ochefu. But when they depart after the season, it looks like they're stocked already for next year. Talk about the recruiting dividend for a Final Four team.
I don't think it can be overstated. There can't be a better billboard for your program than playing deep into the NCAA tournament. Just getting to the Sweet 16 round is great. Getting to the Elite 8 round is great. But when you get to the Final Four, that last focus of the entire season, that pays big, big dividends. Villanova's always recruited very well, but this won't hurt, as you suggest, down the road.
Matching up player versus player, what's the bigger challenge, Oklahoma or potentially Syracuse or North Carolina?
I would say one of the poorer matchups, if there were one, if they were to get that far for them, would be North Carolina. But that said, North Carolina is a bad matchup for every team in the country. They're very big and very talented on the inside. That's not one of Villanova's strengths.
And so, Bob, I'm looking forward to talking to you around this time on Monday. Let's hope there's reason to do so.
Sounds good to me, Dave. Look forward to it.
Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Bob Ford on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead. The office workers of today are training to become the pro wrestlers of tomorrow.
I went to school. I got a real job. I work a real job now. Took a day off today. Drove down from New York to be here just to finally give that pipe dream a chance at becoming a reality.
We'll climb into the ring when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. You finish a soldier, and I stay
under you fighting. Think about this. For just a second, some generic pharmaceutical companies turn a profit by not developing drugs.
Essentially, it's a deal in which the branded drug maker is paying the generic to go away instead of competing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Pay for delay next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers with flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations. Prospective students can drop in anytime during their upcoming information sessions on Wednesday, April 6th and Wednesday, April 20th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more about the University of Delaware MBA, including information on their national ranking from PayScale at udmba.com.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Donald Trump has seemingly united abortion rights and anti-abortion advocates in opposition to his contention this week that if abortion is banned, quote, there has to be some form of punishment for women who violate the restriction. Now, Trump's campaign walked back aspects of that statement, but let's learn toward what end. Joining me in conversation is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, could the gender gap grow any more regarding GOP frontrunner Donald Trump?
Well, anything is possible, and it's grown a little since back in July and August and September when we first started tracking the Donald Trump. But in recent months, despite what he has said, and this is all prior to those remarks, of course, that you mentioned that he made a couple of days ago, it's been fairly stable and huge. That is the gender gap. Let me give you the specific numbers. This is for March. To date, 70% of women in America say they have an unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump. A lonely 23% say they have a favorable opinion. You can do the math there and see how huge a gender gap that is among women. We go back in time, it was 64% of women who had an unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump in December and January of this year. So that's edged up a little to 70% unfavorable. It could go a little further up, but by now we're probably down to those core supporters of Trump who don't seem to want to move at all in their attitudes.
Should it be Trump versus Clinton in November? Is it possible to read those tea leaves?
One question we just finished asking was, how likely would you be to vote for Trump if he were the nominee in November? How likely would you be to vote for Hillary Clinton if she were the nominee and the candidate for the Democratic Party in November? What we find is almost 6 in 10, 58% of Americans right now say no way they would vote for Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton has a lot of baggage, but it's 48% who say they would not vote for her. So right out of the gate, we've got a 10-point gap in the number of people who say they wouldn't vote for Trump, higher than the same question asked about Clinton.
Frank, what's President Barack Obama's approval rating of late?
Last week it was 53%, Dave, and I like to look at the weekly averages because that sorts out kind of the daily ups and downs. That 53% is high. In fact, it's as high as we've seen for Barack Obama since January of 2013, and that's when he was getting inaugurated. He still was on that high that came after his reelection in the fall of 2012. So Obama's approval rating up.
Is it possible to tease out the extent to which that higher approval rating is based on its own merits rather than in studied contrast to the field of candidates?
That's a fascinating question. We can't tease that out scientifically. It's clearly the hypothesis that I think has the most weight is that Obama looks better in contrast to what's going on the Republican side. At this point, he's more statesmanlike. And of course, the candidates criticize Obama in the debates, but a lot of the day-by-day discussion now in the media and elsewhere is not about Obama. It's all this internal going back and forth about the nomination. So Obama at the moment is kind of above it all, and that's probably helping his approval rating edge up, as we've been talking about.
Contrast attention being paid to the election versus enthusiasm for that process.
They're going in different directions. Another fascinating finding, the thought given to the election, which is our classic question that we've been asking for many decades, from January to March, went up by 8 points, 63%. Now it's up to 71% of people who've given quite a lot of thought to the election. So that's the good news. The bad news, how enthusiastic are you about voting this year? That dropped by 5 points from 48 in January, who were extremely or very enthusiastic, down to 43% in March. So it's kind of the more you know about this election so far, the less enthusiastic you are about getting involved in the election.
Are those contrasting trends typical?
Well, it varies by election, but back in 08, we saw enthusiasm continuing to climb as the primary season went on. That's when Barack Obama was the nominee, and there was a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. So I don't think that it's typical that enthusiasm drops as the election process goes on, no.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Pro wrestling fans aplenty will be looking to Texas Stadium near Dallas this weekend as it hosts WrestleMania. Now, long before aspiring wannabes are able to leap off the top turnbuckle into the spotlight of professional wrestling's premier event, they need to master the fundamentals of this unique mashup of athleticism and acting. WHYY's Rob Zavatsky introduces us to the Wrestle Factory in Philadelphia, where would-be grapplers learn the ropes.
This is physical theater is what we're making. So I need to make sure that the people that are 90 rows back can tell what's going on as clearly as the people in the front row. So we need gigantic movements. You must blow up your movements and make them bigger.
Inside a former Philadelphia warehouse, the Wrestle Factory's founder and head trainer, Lightning Mike Quackenbush, is teaching an introduction to wrestling workshop. The students are learning how to lock up, generally the first thing the audience sees in a match. The students grab each other by placing their right hand on the back of their opponent's neck and their left hand at the pit of their opponent's elbow. From here, they can transition into other moves. Ian Freed is one of a dozen novices in the class. A 27-year-old New York City government employee, Freed says he's dreamed of stepping into a professional wrestling ring ever since he was a boy.
I went to school, I got a real job, I work a real job now. Took the day off today, drove down from New York to be here just to finally give that pipe dream a chance at becoming a reality.
Breaking into pro wrestling isn't what it was 20 years ago when Mike Quackenbush got his start. The business is more exposed. It had to admit it's entertainment to avoid being regulated the way baseball or hockey are. And it's undergone a globalization of styles and techniques. He takes these factors into consideration when developing the school's tiered curriculum.
What is relevant to modern-day audiences? What do they want to see put on stage? And what will they think is worthy of their consumer dollars in this day and age? Preoccupies every decision we make in the way that we train people at the Wrestle Factory.
Before becoming a wrestler, Quackenbush studied journalism at the University of Pittsburgh, so he understands the importance of good storytelling. He draws inspiration from books, graphic novels, and TV shows to develop his stories and characters. He will only assign a wrestling persona to people when they can consistently demonstrate mastery of the physical techniques. As far as characters go, Quackenbush says he likes to cast people into roles they never imagined themselves playing.
I'm going to give you something to which you assign no ego. And now, freed of that, freed of making the performance slave to the wants and needs of your heart, what can you bring to the stage?
Drew Gulak has wrestled all over the world. Now he works alongside his former teacher as an instructor at the Wrestle Factory. He says about 10% of people who attend the entry-level workshop end up continuing to take classes. He admits even those who graduate can struggle to make a living inside the squared circle.
There are many, many places for you to work as an independent wrestler today. There's not a lot of money to be made in it because of that, because there's so many. And there's also a shortage of experienced places for you to go and really gain true knowledge as opposed to just figuring it out on your own.
Quackenbush is quick to point out that there are hundreds of wrestling schools, but graduates of the Wrestle Factory have the opportunity to perform in front of paying audiences under the Chikara banner, a family-friendly wrestling promotion owned by Quackenbush that has put on shows across the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan.
The people that finish our program, you see them in our ring. You see them on our events, and they go on tour with us. They're the same people you'll see when we go to Chicago, when we go to New York, later this year when we tour Europe.
A lifelong fan, Ian Fried says he was grateful for the opportunity to see a wrestling ring from the other side of the ropes. He isn't sure if he'll be pursuing wrestling full-time, but he's not ruling out more classes.
Whether this is the only time in my life I'll get to do it, or whether I'm going to do it for a career for years down the road, this was the experience of a lifetime.
For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
This weekend, some string musicians from the Philadelphia Orchestra will recall their roots as they perform with others who learn how to play by the Suzuki method. All the musicians at Sunday's concert at the Trinity Church in Rittenhouse Square started playing at a very young age on tiny instruments. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on a national effort to celebrate the musical teaching system.
For about 50 years now, millions of parents across America have heard their kids practicing this. They put their kids through the Suzuki method of music instruction in the hopes that one day they will sound like this. This is Yumi Kendall and her brother Nick Kendall. They're both professional musicians who started playing through the Suzuki method. That's a teaching philosophy that puts instruments into the hands of children as young as 3 years old before they can read. Yumi Kendall is now assistant principal cellist with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I've always been a cellist because under Grammy and Grandfather's piano was a pawn shop cello. And I was kind of brainwashed into thinking everybody plays an instrument because everybody in my family plays something.
Kendall has a unique connection to the Suzuki method. Her grandfather, the one with the cello under the piano, was John Kendall. That's the American who discovered Dr. Shinichi Suzuki in Japan and introduced his method to the West. Since then, millions of children have learned violin and piano by playing variations of Happy Farmer and Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
There's so many people out there that want to rejoice over this common bond.
This is Nick Kendall.
It's all having to do with how powerful the method was in shaping who we are today.
To that end, Yumi Kendall has created the Suzuki Alumni Project. Through a website and an ongoing series of concerts, the project seeks to connect people who came out of the Suzuki method for networking and celebrating. The Suzuki method is still very strong, according to Jerry Rice. She's a violist and an instructor at Philadelphia's Curtis Institute, where the next generation of professional classical musicians train. She says most of the American students at Curtis came out of Suzuki. Rice herself is a certified Suzuki instructor.
The parents that call me aren't necessarily asking me to make their children professional musicians. They're asking me to teach their children to love music, to learn to be disciplined, to set goals.
The Suzuki Alumni Project collects testimonials praising the method, and not just from professional musicians. Yumi Kendall says people working in a variety of fields credit their music instruction for teaching them focus and discipline.
So whose job is it to celebrate the Suzuki philosophy, the Suzuki movement? It's the alumni. It's our place to say, yeah, thank you so much for my upbringing. Thank you so much for the Suzuki experience that brought me the discipline and joy through my cello playing.
The inaugural concert will be this Sunday, where Suzuki alumni currently in the Philadelphia Orchestra will play Bach, Brahms, and who knows, maybe Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, do you love a good glass of wine but get flustered by the jargon? Philadelphia's sommeliers and wine lovers are riding to the rescue. The third annual Philly Wine Week kicks off Sunday. Among the more than 150 events will be a Learn Your Lingo tasting session. Wine Week co-founder Kate Maroney Miller sympathizes with the wine newbie.
The terminology, the wine terms that are used regularly are really intimidating. And a lot of times people end up smiling and nodding, a little blank stare occasionally. And so this tasting is really all about giving simple, clear examples of commonly used wine terms.
And if you'd like to bone up on those terms on your own, Kate Maroney Miller gave a preview lesson to WHYY's Marilyn D'Angelo. You can hear their conversation on the Plated blog at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production this week from the intrepid Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Bob Alls, Al Banks, and Adam Stanishevsky. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.